cat reached an arm back and grabbed Amy's wrist before the young woman could dart to the side, toward one of the shrouded tanks. Amy had come along with Cat to discover the fate of her sister.
"That's not her," Cat said, drawing Amy closer. "That's just a husk, a shell. Your sister died when she was taken through those doors."
Amy resisted for a couple of steps, then surrendered, knowing Cat was right. They hurried together, each needing the warmth of the other. The hallway ended at a line of three glass-walled offices, all facing the horror show. Other hallways branched to the left and the right, likely leading to smaller labs, storerooms, and mechanical spaces. Cat noted the names etched on the three doors. She memorized them, intending to hold the persons accountable if she ever got out of here. But she moved to the centermost and largest of the three. The name on the door read, "Dr. Nancy Marshall, M.D., D.S.C., Ph.D., A.B.O.G." It seemed the more abbreviated letters followed a name, the less humanity remained. Through the glass door, Cat spotted a computer glowing with a screensaver depicting a slowly spiraling helix of DNA. She found the lock unfastened and hurried inside, crossing to the computer. She reached to wake the monitor up, then paused, noting something odd about the screensaver. The glowing high-definition image detailed a thick double helix of DNA, slowly spinning, all color-coded, mapping out nucleotides, codons, and chemical bonds. She leaned closer, studying a strange abnormality. A third strand of protein wound within the double helix, entwined into the genetic matrix like a snake in the grass. Biology and genetics were not her specialty, but she knew someone at Sigma who could better analyze this data. Reaching to the mouse, she woke up the computer. A standard desktop appeared. She needed to secure as much of the data stored on that hard drive as possible and transmit it back to DC, but she also knew she didn't have time to crack whatever passwords locked this system from the outside world. There was no way to email or send files electronically. The firewalls around this complex were fierce and military grade. She would have to improvise and hope for the best. Reaching into her breast pocket, she removed her surveillance pen. The camera's video and audio were recorded to a secure digital SD card linked to a cellular transceiver. But the data could also be manually ported over, if necessary, via a built-in USB connection. She twisted the pen, shedding the camera features, leaving behind the 2 terabyte storage card linked to a USB adapter. Working fast, she found the USB port in the desktop's tower and shoved the drive in place. Her intent was not to download the card's content, but to upload files to it, hoping they'd eventually reach Sigma. With the guts of her pen exposed, Cat noted the cellular transceiver glowing a pinpoint green. It remained active, but was anyone picking up the signal? She straightened as a new icon blinked onto the screen's desktop, representing her flash drive. A rumble drew her attention around. Amy stood at the open office door, staring back to the far end of the lab. The steel doors had begun to slowly open, unsealing and cracking with a sliver of light. Dr. Marshall's sharp bark carried through. "Find them!" Cat returned to the computer. No time to be picky about which files to grab. Using the mouse, she dragged the image of the computer's hard drive and dumped it all onto the thumbnail for the SD flash drive. Files immediately began transferring. That's all she could do for now. Except survive. 6:41 p.m. What the hell was that? Painter stared over at General Metcalf. He'd never heard the man swear, seldom saw him lose composure. The pair stood before the bank of monitors in the communications nest. Minutes ago, the technician monitoring Cat's surveillance pen reported new feed coming from her second device. This was the first video transmission since the pen had been activated. They'd picked up some initial audio, snatches of conversation, but nothing afterward. Then suddenly the screen had bloomed to life.
The first few minutes were a jumbled confusion until the camera settled on a set of red metal doors with a cross symbol emblazoned on them. Metcalf had just been leaving when the monitor sprang to life, exciting the technician. The general accompanied Painter to observe what was picked up. Together, they viewed in growing dismay as Kat surveyed a dark lab revealing rows of women in tanks. Then she continued to some offices at the back of the room.
"Did you get those names?" Painter asked the technician. "The ones on the office doors?"
"Yes, sir."
After that, the monitor went dark once again.
"Is that everything?" Metcalf asked. "Where was this footage taken?"
Painter knew he had to come clean.
"About everything."
He drew the general back into the side office. Once inside, with the door closed, he explained. Captain Bryant was investigating a fertility clinic in South Carolina, the same facility where Amanda had her in vitro fertilization performed. But it hadn't been just Kat conducting that investigation. Lisa had gone down there, too. Fear for her stoked brighter, but he had to stay focused. Metcalf turned toward him.
"What fertility clinic are you talking about?"
"Who authorized?" Painter cut him off before he worked up a full head of steam. He needed to shock the man into listening, for all of their sakes.
"Amanda may still be alive."
As he expected, those few words knocked the man back a step. Painter continued, not letting the general recover. He needed to present the entire picture before Metcalf started to put up mental roadblocks. Only the complete story could win this stubborn man to their cause. Painter started at the beginning, with Amanda's kidnapping and his belief that it was tied to the unborn child she carried. They ended in front of Kat's office computer. Painter showed him the cross atop the island of Utopia, realizing just then that it matched the symbol on the red steel doors.
What did that mean?
Metcalf sank to the desk chair, his eyes fixed to the screen. The general was a tough man, a skilled player in the ways of power and politics, some would even say an opportunist. But that was a requirement to function in the Beltway politics of D.C. Painter also knew the general to be a shrewd strategist, capable of putting logic before emotion. He hoped that proved to be the case now. "And all of these properties are owned by the Gant family?"
"The president's family?"
Metcalf asked, staring at the island.
"And you've already received confirmation that Amanda was taken there?"
"Yes." Behind that glaze of shock, Painter saw the gears churning through all the evidence. Finally, Metcalf shook his head, not in disbelief, more like defeat.
"Dear God! If you're right..."
He placed a palm on his forehead and stared Painter square in the eye. "Even if the Gants are the puppet masters behind the guild, how could the president involve his own daughter with something like this?" The general glanced to that dark monitor in the other room, obviously picturing the horror show from a moment ago.
"James Gant may not know," Painter explained. "We don't know which of the Gants are in that inner circle, the true bloodline. That's why I've been playing this game so cagily. I have a gut feeling that inner circle is not without internal friction or dissent."
"Why do you say that?"
"Something sent Amanda running to the Seychelles, almost like she was tipped off, like someone was trying to protect her. Or maybe they purposefully tricked her into fleeing in secret so she could be nabbed out of the public eye."
It was a more cynical hypothesis, one Painter hadn't even considered, proving yet again that Metcalf was an expert chess player.
"You've built a case against the Gants," Metcalf conceded, "but it's far from solid. None of this is strong enough to confront them, especially the administration. If we tried, we'd end up tipping our hand too soon, exposing that we're onto them. The backlash would burn us down, and that bloodline would bury itself even deeper. There's only one solution."
Painter understood.
"We need Amanda."
Metcalf met his eyes, confirming this. Any hope for Sigma to rise from these ashes depended on recovering and securing the president's daughter.
And surely the bloodline knew that, too. A knock at the door drew both their attentions. It was Kat's chief analyst, Jason Carter. Painter motioned him forward, but the kid only stuck his head through the door. "Director, we're receiving new data from Captain Bryant's device." Painter stared past the young man's head. The monitor was still black.
"Is it new video or just audio again?"
"Neither. They're digital files." Painter's eyes pinched with momentary confusion, then realized what Kat was doing. Downloading information off one of the lab's computers.
"Clever, Kat. Very smart."
"Start forwarding those files to me," Painter said.
Jason nodded and ducked back out. Metcalf waited with Painter.
"I wish you hadn't told me any of this," he said. "I'd certainly sleep better not knowing. For that matter, why did you tell me? Why trust me? Who's to say I'm not on the Guild's payroll?"
It was a good question, and Painter had only one answer.
"Because you've been a thorn in Sigma's side from the beginning."
"You mean I've been an ass?"
Painter didn't argue with his wording.
"But you've also had our back, sir, when we've truly needed it. And besides, I can't do this on my own. Not any longer. I need an ally, someone to hold the wolves at bay if we're to have any chance of recovering Amanda."
"You'll get it.
But there's only so much I can do. After what happened in Somalia, Sigma has a big target on its back. And you know Washington. Once they smell blood in the water, the feeding frenzy begins."
The intercom buzzed. "Director, the initial files are up on your desktop."
"I'll leave you to this," Metcalf said, standing and letting Painter take his seat. "This castle's about to be stormed, and I'm better off manning the gates and fortifying the ramparts."
Painter knew his statement was more than a simile. Sigma headquarters lay in the bunkers beneath the Smithsonian castle, within the shadows of the White House. Even now, the battle lines were being drawn between them. As Metcalf left, Painter turned his attention to the computer, to the files gained at such risk. He worried about Kat, and even more about Lisa. Still, he sensed that all of the mysteries, the true pulse of the bloodline, lay in the life or death of another woman.
"Gray, you must find Amanda."
Chapter 25. July 3rd, 2:44 a.m., Gulf Standard Time, off the coast of Dubai. Gray held the man's neck in the crook of his arm, the flat of his hand against the side of his head. A twist and a sharp crank on the chin shattered the guard's cervical vertebrae. The strangled body fell limp. He lowered the guard to the lawn and began stripping off the man's helmet, vest, and shirt. The gear was identical to that worn by the commandos back in Somalia, offering further proof that Amanda had been moved here. In his earpiece,
"Done."
That was Seishan. She had taken down her man. As Gray strapped on the dead soldier's helmet, he glanced at the phone in his hand. On the screen, a dog's eye view revealed a lone guard posted beside a park bench. Kane moved nearer, drawing the man's attention, while Tucker closed in from behind with a blade. As silently as the others, he dispatched the last guard that stood between Gray's team and the twisted spire of the Burj Abadi, the Eternal Tower.
"Move in," Gray radioed.
He ran low through the remainder of the nighttime park, still wary, in case Kane had missed any hidden guards. But no alarm was raised as he reached the edge of the grounds. As he waited for the others, he looked up at the sheer majesty of the slowly turning tower, each floor revolving independently of the others. He imagined the view must be breathtaking from up top, the scene eternally changing, spanning from the panoramic brilliance of Dubai's skyline to the dark mystery of the starlit sea. Still, something bothered Gray as he stared upward. Something about its ever-changing shape. A rustle drew his attention back to the ground. The others converged from different directions. Seishan and Tucker came similarly outfitted in stolen gear. Kane kept out of sight, slinking wide upon a signal from his handler. As they gathered to him, Gray studied the front entrance to the Borj Abadi. He expected there would be cameras watching the steps and lobby, possibly other guards inside. The disguise was a feeble one, but the ruse could buy them an extra few seconds of surprise if needed. Kowalski finally pushed past a grove of palms, struggling to pull a small vest over his wide shoulders. The helmet sat on top of his head like a crown.
"My guy was pint-sized," he explained.
Gray pointed his rifle at the big man. "Drop all of that and put your hands on your head." Kowalski frowned.
"What the hell, Pierce?"
Seishan sighed.
"Just act like a prisoner."
She waved toward the lobby stairs.
"For the cameras."
Understanding slowly sank through Kowalski's thick skull, widening his eyes. He shed his stolen gear and laced his fingers atop his head. With a few final instructions, Gray marched Kowalski forward, flanked by the other two. From the corner of his eye, he caught a blur of shadow, easy to miss unless watching for it. Kane vanished into the bushes at the base of the building and crept from there toward the same stairs. Bright lights lit the steps, but the lobby was dark, with only a few pools of subdued illumination inside. It looked deserted. Maybe their disguises weren't necessary. The guards in the park had certainly been easy to take down. Gray had even caught his target sleeping. The enemy plainly must have thought themselves safe out on this island, especially since they suspected no one was looking for Amanda. Gray led the others up the stairs. They kept their faces lowered from the cameras. Gray motioned for Tucker to run ahead and check the tall glass doors that led into the lobby. The man ran forward and tugged. The door swung open, unlocked. Tucker looked relieved. It saved them the trouble and exposure of using the mini pellets of C4 to blast the deadbolts or larger pyrotechnics if necessary. The only one disappointed by the ease of entry was the team's explosives and demolitions expert.
"Oh, man," Kowalski groused. "I was all set to blow some crap up."
Gray poked him in the back with his rifle.
"Keep moving."
Kowalski stumbled across the threshold. Gray and the others crowded in behind him. The lobby soared 5 stories high, drawing the eye up. In the center rose a grand spiral staircase, made entirely of glass and sparkling in the wan light with Swarovski crystals and figurines depicting sea creatures. It wound up from the grand entry hall, spiraling around the central axis of the tower and continuing ever upward. The only illumination came from a ring of huge pillars, also made of glass. They formed massive vertical aquariums, glowing with an inner soft radiance that slowly shifted along a spectrum of hues. Initially, Gray thought the aquariums were empty, merely bubbling on the inside, catching and multiplying the glow. Then his eyes adjusted, and the bubbles became palm-sized jellyfish, swarming and drifting within the giant pillars. The wonder of the moment was interrupted by a harsh call. A towering, beefy figure rose out of hiding from behind a security desk and stalked forward, rubbing a knuckle in one eye. Someone else had been caught napping. The man shoved a black beret on his head, clearly the leader of this African contingent. A second figure crawled from behind the desk and stood. A dark-skinned girl of 13 or 14, slim, frail-limbed, wearing a soldier's uniform. She wiped her mouth with the back of her hand. The leader's pants were unbuttoned. So, the man hadn't been caught sleeping. Fury roiled up inside Gray. He knew many of the village children nabbed by the warlords of Somalia weren't all turned into soldiers, like Bashi, but instead were brutalized as sex slaves. Or both. The monster's gaze remained fixed on Kowalski as he stalked across the wide lobby, clearly mystified by the sudden appearance of this prisoner. The ruse would only last another couple of sec- The leader froze. half skidding on one foot, his hand lunging for his holstered pistol. Seishan whipped her Sig Sauer out.
Don't shoot! Gray snapped.
The noise of a firefight, even a single shot in this crystal echo chamber, would surely draw any other guards and alert the enemy hidden within. The leader freed his sidearm, under no such restraint, but Gray had seen the flicker of movement from Tucker's wrist, heard a whispered command over the radio. Kane burst out of the shadows behind the man and barreled forward. The girl squealed, dancing to the side. The dog hit the man in the ankle, hamstringing him and flinging him into the air. He flew high, then landed hard, his head striking the marble floor. His pistol slid away into the shadows. Tucker was already moving, charging forward, blade in his fist. He slid on his knees, passing Kane, whose momentum carried him in the opposite direction. Tucker reached the down man, raised his dagger, then simply lowered it.
"Neck's broken," Tucker said.
"So we each got a soldier,"
Kowalski said, lowering his arms, rubbing his shoulders.
"I gotta get me one of those dogs."
From the shadows to the side, the young girl reappeared. She held the lost pistol in both hands, pointed at Tucker. Her face was a mask of terror. Tucker dropped his dagger and raised his palms.
"It's okay," the man intoned softly.
The girl spat something in Somali. They didn't have a translator, but it sounded more angry than scared. She steadied her pistol, her finger finding the trigger. Then the girl suddenly jerked back a step, coughed blood. She dropped the pistol, her fingers scrabbling for the silver blade sticking out of her neck. Gray turned to the source. Seishan had a second throwing dagger in her fingers, ready if needed. It wasn't. The girl slumped to her knees, then toppled forward. Tucker gave out a soft cry of dismay. He lunged forward, going to the child's aid, but it was no use.
"What did you do?"
"What needed to be done,"
Seishan said, her eyes glassy and cold. Tucker stared across at her.
"She was just a child."
"No, she wasn't,"
Seishan whispered under her breath.
"Not any longer."
Logically, Gray knew she was right. The girl would likely have shot and killed Tucker. The noise would have jeopardized everything. And a sad truth of the matter, some brutalized war orphans never recovered, never healed, becoming no more than animals in children's bodies. Still, his heart ached at the death, echoing Tucker's anguish. Seishan merely headed across the lobby.
"Let's find Amanda. That's what we came here for."
Still, he noted her fingers trembled as she tried to return the unused blade to its wrist sheath.
"Seishan's right," Gray said, and pointed to Tucker. "Get your dog. We need to pick up Amanda's trail."
Tucker glowered at Seishan, but he obeyed. As dog and handler worked in tandem, sweeping through the lobby, Gray moved to the security desk. There he found a bank of monitors. It appeared the desk was wired to the lobbies on each floor. He began hitting each button, bringing up one view after the other, looking for any evidence of habitation. Reaching the penthouse lobby on the 50th floor, he came up empty. Every lobby was dark, offering a dim view of marble elegance, fine rugs, and the continuation of the spiral stair. Everything looked deserted, untouched.
"Over here," Tucker called quietly. "I think we found something."
Kane sniffed furiously at one of the doors along a curved bay of elevators. Gray crossed toward him, collecting Seishan along the way. She stood off by herself, staring into one of the aquarium pillars, her face unreadable. As he reached her, she nodded to the glowing and swirling pillar of jellyfish in front of her, reading the sign. "It's a giant hybrid of Turritopsis nutricula." He shook his head, not understanding. "At the end of this species' life, the adult jellyfish reverts back to a juvenile state. This cycle repeats over and over again, starting fresh each time." She stared over at the bloodied girl. Her eyes were damp with tears, possibly seeing herself lying there. Did she wish for such a chance? For both of them to be reborn? To start again, pure and untainted? To have their childhoods back? The process makes the jellyfish immortal, she whispered. He nodded, understanding this unusual marvel of nature. No wonder it's the mascot for the Eternal Tower. But Seishan had a different viewpoint about life everlasting and mumbled it aloud. It's so horrible. Gray didn't comment as she turned away. He followed silently with her and allowed her to work through her grief, to process it. He did keep close to her side, letting fingers brush along the back of her hand, the one that had thrown the dagger. He expected her to pull away, but she didn't. They joined Tucker and Kane. Kowalski stood nearby, neck craned, staring up, following the coil of the crystal staircase through the heart of the eternally spiraling tower. Gray followed his gaze, again, nagged by something. Something about the shape. 6:47 p.m., Eastern Standard Time, Washington, D.C. The DNA molecule slowly spiraled on the computer screen, a dance of code that mapped out the human body in all its glory. But this fragment of genetic material was unlike anything Painter had ever seen diagrammed. A third strand snaked within the heart of the typical double helix. What do you make of it? Painter asked, using the mystery here to keep him distracted from his worries about Kat and Lisa. It's a triple helix, Rennie Quinn said, his voice flush with awe. The holy grail of genetics. Rennie leaned his large fists on Kat's desk to stare closer. Sigma's resident biogeneticist had been summoned to help Painter sift through the huge volume of data coming from that lab's servers. The man was of Irish descent, with a ruddy complexion and dark auburn stubble over his scalp and cheeks. He was also a former college boxer, which included a fair amount of bare-knuckle brawling, which got him discharged from the Army Rangers. Afterward, Sigma grabbed him up. Rennie proved the stories true of men with big hands, but in his case, it meant he had a huge brain, and Rennie was going to need it to slog through this mountain of data. The files from Charleston arrived disordered and unclassified, much of it in raw code. Kat must not have had time to pare the data down to the most essential files. Instead, what arrived was the definition of a data dump, a load far more than the SD card in her pen could handle. A lot of the files came corrupted, others not fully decrypted. As a consequence, it could take days, if not weeks, to decipher, decode, and repair the damaged files. Still, it didn't take a computer engineer to ascertain that most of the files dealt with advanced genetics and reproductive studies, all tracing directly or indirectly back to this one image. A triple helix of DNA, Painter said, staring at the monitor as perplexed as he was intrigued. Actually, Rennie leaned over and dragged a finger down two of the spiraling backbones. These strands are deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA. The third, this snake wrapped around the tree of life, is peptide nucleic acid, or PNA. Rennie tapped the new helix. This strand is artificial. Man engineered this, not God. What we're looking at is the result of cybergenetics, the merging of biology and technology. Is that even possible? Not only possible, it's been done. A team over at the University of Copenhagen have already managed to insert a PNA strand between two DNA strands. In a test tube, of course. But the only obstacle to moving their research to the next stage is a simple hurdle. Rennie nodded to the screen. That triple helical assembly isn't stable in water. Build a raincoat around that strand and the whole world changes. Painter frowned up at him. What do you mean? Rennie explained.
Our entire genetic code is built on four chemical bases: guanine, adenine, thymine, and cytosine. GATC. From that four-letter vocabulary, all life is formed. He cocked an eye at the spiraling molecule. But PNA is not restricted to those four letters. Can you imagine what could be created with more letters of the alphabet? We could rewrite mankind. Despite Rennie's obvious excitement, Painter imagined only horrors. But far more importantly, Rennie pressed, this cyber strand of PNA can be designed to specifically turn on and off certain genes. PNA has already been used to cure a form of muscular dystrophy in lab mice. But that's just the beginning. The potential is limitless. We're talking about blocking cancer, treating hundreds of genetic diseases, even extending life. Rennie stared longingly at the computer. If DNA holds the key to life, then PNA is its lockpick. Whoever holds that tool in hand, nothing would be impossible. Painter's dismay grew darker, picturing the lab in Charleston, the women floating in tanks. Jason tapped at the open office door and saved him from having to ponder worse.
Director, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we just finished receiving an extremely large file from Charleston. I thought you might like to see it. The folder's name is History and Origins.
Painter sat straighter, happy to forego any more biological discussions for now. He wanted to get to the root of everything, and that file name sounded promising. History and Origins. Jason dashed some of that hope.
But sir, the folder's badly corrupted. We're working on it, but I can forward what we have so far. A couple odd pictures and documents.
Do it, Painter said.
Jason pointed to the computer. Already done.
No wonder Cat loves this kid. Painter swung to the keyboard and clicked open the first few uncorrupted documents. A drawing filled the screen. It showed a trio of men in colonial attire, with their arms clasped together, gripping right hands above their heads and left hands below. In both of the upper corners of the sketch, a pair of three-headed snakes coiled. What is this? Painter mumbled, not expecting an answer, but he got one.
That's the Holy Royal Arch, Rennie said, sounding equally surprised to know the answer.
Painter turned to him. How do you know that?
Because I'm a member of the guild.
Rennie must have read Painter's stunned look.
Not that guild. I'm talking about the Masons. My family has been members going back to our time in Ireland.
Painter pointed to the screen. And this?
Don't know a whole lot about it. What's drawn there is the ritual of 3x3, a sacred number in Freemasonry. It's a part of the initiation into the Royal Arch degree, but plenty of mystery surrounds that exclusive degree, like its exact origin. It's said to be tied back to the Knights Templar, the 3x3 ritual. In other words, 9, represent the original 9 founding members of the Knights Templar.
Painter stared at the screen. What is this drawing doing on the servers of a genetics lab? Despite the oddity, he had a suspicion of the answer, but only because of the previous discussion with Rennie. Painter studied the three men entwined together, the three-headed snakes. It was eerily similar to the three-stranded helix, three wound together as one. Even Rennie had used the term a snake wrapped around the tree of life to describe the triple helix. Painter read the annotation at the bottom of the drawing, stating the source, a book titled Duncan's Masonic Ritual and Monitor, printed back in 1866. How could a book dated almost a century and a half ago be referencing, at least symbolically, a triple helix? Painter was reminded of the file folder's name, History and Origins. Sensing the importance here, he wanted the rest of this folder decrypted as soon as possible, if it was possible. Jason suddenly dashed back to the door with grim news.
Director, we just lost connection to Charleston. The feed from Captain Bryant's device suddenly ceased in mid-transmission.
Painter sat straighter. The pen's battery? Did it die?
No, sir. This time we're monitoring the charge levels. It was still good.
Painter's heart sank, knowing there was only one explanation left. Jason stated it aloud.
Someone must have discovered her bug and disabled it.
But what did that mean for Kat? Chapter 26. July 2nd, 6:48 p.m., Eastern Standard Time, Charleston, South Carolina.
Find them!
Kat slipped silently into a side room off the dark lab hallway. Before disappearing inside, she caught a peek of Dr. Marshall at the far end, storming out of her office, surrounded by a cadre of security guards.
Split up! Search every closet, storage space, and lab on both sides!
Kat closed the door quietly, struggling with the handle due to her greasy palm. The room was lit only by the glowing screensaver of a computer monitor. Again, it depicted that strange triple helix. Kat hoped the files she'd been downloading had reached somebody at Sigma. As her eyes adjusted to the gloom, she noted the neighboring wall contained shelves of 5-liter glass jars, reflecting the meager light. Dark things lurked and floated inside. Kat caught the barest glimpse of curled, tiny fingers. She turned her back, not wanting to see more, not after witnessing the horrors out in the main room. The women in the tanks. These jars likely held the end product of that research. Kat still held her folding combat blade, dulled now from all the hacking and sawing. She'd had only 2 minutes to ready herself for the siege ahead, barely enough time to get Amy hidden and out of harm's way. In her head, calculations continued to run as a mental timer ticked down. 7 tanks. 300 PSIA tank. Estimated volume of laboratory space. She heard doors opening and slamming, men shouting orders, working swiftly down the hall toward her position. She had left a door open farther back, but the guards would reach her first, as planned. She closed her eyes, taking several deep breaths. She used the extra seconds to smear more of the gelatinous fluid over her face and shaved scalp, leaving a thick film. Her clothes and the rest of her body were equally slathered and dripping with the hydrophilic gel, the same pinkish material that was filling the monstrous tanks in the main room. Footsteps pounded up to her hiding place. She faced the door as it was ripped open. A guard, then another, came charging inside with pistols pointed at Kat.
"Drop the knife," one of them screamed.
She obeyed, lifting her hands to the top of her head. The other one yelled out the door,
"Found one of them! Bring her to me," Marshall ordered.
The guards manhandled her out the door and into the hallway. She didn't resist and allowed herself to be led at gunpoint toward the pool of light radiating from Marshall's office. The woman stood with her hands on her hips. She ground a boot heel against the vinyl floor. Kat heard a crack and saw a bit of black plastic go flying across the floor. They'd found her surveillance pin plugged into their network. Marshall faced her, her cheeks livid, her eyes fiery. She already had her palm resting on her cattle prod. Kat expected to be punished, needed to be punished.
"Where is the other girl?" Marshall demanded.
Kat made sure never to break eye contact, not to betray Amy's hiding place with the flicker of a glance.
"I'll make you talk."
Marshall stalked up to her and jammed the prod at her belly. Kat twisted at the last second as blue sparks spat from the black wand's end. Pinned by the guards behind her, she still caught a glancing shock on her hip. Electric fire lanced along her side, crippling her left leg into an agonized spasm, forcing her into a painful crouch. Kat ground her teeth against the pain, and in frustration.
"Too low."
Pushing up with her good leg, Kat lunged and caught Marshall's wrist. One of the guards tried to pistol whip her, but Kat dodged enough to take the blow to her shoulder. Kat struggled with her quivering leg, grabbing a handful of plastic curtain that hid the tanks to keep her upright. She still had a grip on Marshall's wrist and shoved her cattle prod high,
The metal tip struck the curtain rod overhead. Sparks danced. Then the world became fire. The detonation blew Cat backward, sent her flying through the air. Overhead, blue flames chased across the ceiling after her and spread outward. She covered her eyes with her arm, picturing that fire racing down the hallway toward the farthest room, a storage and mechanical space holding all manner of pressurized gas tanks that service the many labs of the complex, including seven large tanks marked with the symbol H2. Hydrogen gas. Odorless, 14 times lighter than air, highly explosive. She had hacked through the lines earlier, bleeding the massive tanks into this enclosed space, knowing the gas would stay high and be undetectable to the nose. Cat landed on her back on the floor and slid, the heat blistering overhead, broiling all beneath. The only thing that kept the skin on her body was the thick hydrophilic gel that covered her. The same watery properties that kept the patients in the tanks moist and free of bed sores offered her some meager insulation. The same couldn't be said for the others. Screams cut through her blast-muffled ears. Bodies flailed, clothes on fire, faces burned away. In that split second during the explosion, Cat had watched Marshall's hair ignite, turning into a swirling nimbus of flames. A fitting end for a woman who played God. Cat struggled up, choking from the smoke, from the heat, from the lack of air. Her tearing eyes turned the view into a watery hell. All around, fires danced, plastic draping melted in blackened flows, and charred equipment sparked and sizzled. She gained her feet and took a stumbling step backward. Another figure rose from the floor 2 yards away, climbing from behind the shelter of a tank. Her scalp was burned and cracked, pouring blood. Marshall lifted her arm, holding one of the guard's pistols in her hand, and stumbled around the tank. Cat tried to get to shelter, but her legs betrayed her. She fell on her side, supported by one arm. Marshall came another step forward, the pistol pointed at Cat's face. Her gaze showed no glee at the kill to come, only a pained necessity, a last act of revenge. But it wasn't she who got that revenge. From the tank next to her, the naked body rose, sitting up like a corpse from a grave. Marshall turned toward the movement, her deadened eyes suddenly going bright with terror. An arm pulled out of the gelatinous muck, drawing out a long black baton. The weapon swung with the heavy grief of a sister in mourning. The hard metal cracked Marshall across the bridge of the nose, shattering through bone. The doctor dropped. Cat realized in retrospect, this is a more fitting death for a woman who played God. Amy climbed out of the tank and hurried to Cat and helped her back to her feet. I thought you were dead. I thought I was too. Earlier, Cat had dragged Denise, Amy's sister, out of her viscous crib, replacing her sibling there instead. Cat had stripped Amy of her hospital gown and made sure the girl was sunk deeply into the tub, well coated with the insulating gel. Afterward, Cat had scooped handfuls of the same and covered herself, too, then carried Denise's thin body to the storage room. Cat had wanted Amy hidden in plain sight, knowing no one would look too closely at the occupants of those tanks. She also wanted the girl close to the exit, not trapped down the fiery hall. Confirming that wisdom, a massive explosion ripped from that direction, spraying shrapnel and shattering glass. Cat pictured all of the other pressurized tanks back there, overheating, leaking gas, catching fire. She also envisioned flames chasing through the gas tubing and conduits, spreading to other floors, other buildings. "Let's go," Cat gasped out hoarsely. She retrieved the pistol from Marshall's limp fingers, and together they fled through the smoke and fire and back through the red steel doors. In the ward, alarms blared and sprinklers overhead sprayed fiercely. Cat stopped long enough to grab another gown for Amy and hurried out the doors. Down the hall, they discovered the guard station empty. No one tried to stop them as they fled up out of the fiery bowels of the building and onto the ground floor of one of the rear buildings of the campus. The view outside showed the rest of the facility succumbing to the spreading flames. The summer sun was still up,
but it looked like dusk outside as smoke obscured the gardens. Across the way, fire danced behind other windows. An explosion blew out an upper section of the main building, showering bricks and broken roof tiles. It was all coming down. Cat grabbed Amy's arm and hurried her through the exit and out into the park-like grounds. Other researchers fled for the gates to the street, looking shell-shocked. Cat followed them, doing her best to keep her pistol hidden. In the distance, sirens echoed. Cat and Amy ran down the entry road and out the gates, chased by more blasts and deep-throated explosions. Debris rained down around them. Smoke rolled thickly now, making it hard to see. They fled farther down the street, trying to break clear, to get some distance away from the conflagration. At last, they reached a clear section of road. They both panted, hands on knees. Sirens grew louder, converging all around as emergency crews responded from throughout Charleston. Cat straightened and pointed toward the blue lights flashing through the smoke. "You should..." The crack of a pistol echoed. Amy fell back, sitting down on the road. She reached a palm to her chest as blood bloomed through her gown. Cat twisted and dropped to a knee, swinging up her weapon. An SUV sat on the side of the road, a back window open. Movement inside. She fired wildly at the dark car. 6:55 p.m. Lisa dropped low in the back seat as the windshield cracked and shattered. She was pinned between two burly guards. In the front, the driver and Dr. Paul Cranston crouched. "Christ," the shooter next to her said. "She's got a gun." Lisa covered her head. "What's happening?" After nabbing her off the streets of downtown Charleston, Cranston and his men had returned to the fertility center, confident after their hunt, only to be greeted by a loud explosion as they turned into view. The concussion rattled the SUV's windows. Smoke curled up from one of the back buildings. Flames began to spread. Then more blasts as the place ripped apart. Cranston had them retreat a block to observe the incineration and destruction of his hard work, unable to look away. He hissed from up front. "Take her out, goddammit, before she escapes. If she gets loose..." While surveying the aftermath from a safe distance, Cranston had spotted a pair of women running out of the smoke, both shaven-headed, one in a hospital gown. He recognized them immediately. "They're from the lower lab." He'd ordered them shot, gunned down like rabid dogs, but it seemed one of the women had teeth. The gunman next to Lisa returned to the open window, shoving out one arm, his weapon pointed. Another spat of gunfire peppered the side of the truck. The man swore, but held his post. Lisa risked a peek. She saw the woman with the pistol drag the wounded girl toward the shelter of the thicker smoke. Sirens screamed now, and the flash of emergency lights grew brighter through the haze. Then the woman glanced over her shoulder, back toward the SUV. It was the first time Lisa got a good look at her face. Recognition rocked through her, even with all her friends' hair shorn away. "Cat!"
"Got her,"
the shooter said with deadly satisfaction.
"No!"
Lisa lunged and hit the man with her shoulder. His pistol fired, his aim thrown. Lisa got her head out, saw Cat unharmed, and she intended her friend to stay that way.
"Cat, run!"
Her other guard yanked her roughly back. Cranston raised enough to peer into the back seat. He fixed Lisa with a knowing gaze. She immediately read the understanding there.
"So that's who you were working with," Cranston said,
and ordered his men to secure Cat. The gunman balled a fist in Lisa's hair and dragged her out, using her body as a human shield. Cat had found thin shelter behind a recycling bin. Cranston called from up front,
"Drop your weapon! Come out, or we'll put a bullet through the back of your friend's head."
"Don't!"
Lisa screamed at her friend. The fist in her hair shook hard, ripping follicles. She watched in despair as Cat threw her pistol out, then stepped into view.
"Go get her," Cranston ordered the other guard. "I want some answers, but don't hesitate to shoot her if she gives you any trouble."
Cat must have sensed the same and came along willingly, her fingers laced on top of her head.
What about the other one? Cranston asked when the guard returned with Kat.
Dead.
Kat and Lisa made their reunion in the middle of the back seat, trapped between the pair of armed men.
I'm so sorry, Lisa whispered.
Kat's face was a hard mask of rage, but not directed at her. Kat's hand found hers and squeezed, holding so much promise in that small gesture. Reassurance, forgiveness, and a guarantee of revenge. Emergency vehicles began to appear, whipping past their parked vehicle, sirens ablaze and lights blinding. Where now? The driver asked as he started the engine. Cranston stared toward the burning wreckage of his clinic.
Out of the city.
It's a little too hot here now. He turned from the fire and smoke. We'll take them for a ride in the country. To the lodge. 7:12 p.m. Washington, D.C. From his post in the communications nest, Painter watched the fiery footage from South Carolina. It was a live feed, shot by one of the two men he'd sent out to investigate the North Charleston Fertility Clinic. His team had arrived on site 15 minutes ago. A chaos of fire crews fought the blaze. Towering arcs of water sprayed from trucks and ladders. Paramedics, along with other first response teams, serviced burn injuries and smoke inhalation. Other victims had lacerations and bruises from flying debris and glass. Four bodies had tarps over them. Painter expected there would be more. Would Kat or Lisa be among them? When the security detail first reported in, Painter had hoped the destruction was Kat's handiwork, but it could just as easily have been a fail-safe measure. Someone had found Kat's bug, and the guild was notorious for its scorched earth policy. He'd seen it himself multiple times in the past. If anyone got too close, the guild would burn all bridges that might lead to them, to their secrets. It didn't matter the cost, consequences, or lives. Director. He turned to find Jason Carter at his shoulder. Again.
I want you to see something, the kid said, and drew him to a monitor where another analyst worked.
Though the seated man was a decade older, Jason rested a hand on his shoulder like an encouraging father.
Linus and I were working on a research project for Kat before she left.
We've been working on it for about 3 months, Linus added.
What's this about?
Painter's patience was thread thin, but he waved for them to continue.
I asked Linus to test our new protocols in the search for Captain Bryant and Dr. Cummings, Jason said. I hope that was all right.
Of course.
At this point, he'd take any help.
What were you testing?
A new surveillance and tracking system similar to current facial recognition programs. But instead of faces, we applied it to motor vehicles. Once on the road, the wear and tear on an automobile creates a unique pattern, as individual as any person's fingerprints or facial features.
Is this going somewhere? Painter asked.
Jason rushed ahead.
I took the liberty of gathering the database from your security team in Charleston. You asked them to collect video from the traffic and security cams around that restaurant.
And nothing came up.
Right. So I had Linus collect similar data from the cameras in North Charleston, gathering video footage from all the vehicles passing through that neighborhood. We took all that information and ran it through our new vehicle recognition program.
And?
Jason squeezed Linus's shoulder. He brought up side-by-side images on his monitor. It showed two partial views of a nondescript Ford SUV.
Jason continued, I think our targets were purposely avoiding traffic cams. It's not hard to do if you know which intersections are monitored.
And they would know that, Painter thought. It's their home turf.
We got these images off a couple of bank ATM cameras. The picture on the left was taken 3 blocks from the restaurant where Dr. Cummings vanished. The second crossed a bridge about 4 blocks from the clinic.
Jason faced him.
They're the same vehicle.
Painter countered skeptically.
There are a lot of Ford SUVs on the road.
Not that match the exact same pattern of wear and tear. But I wanted to be sure. That's why I called you over.
Jason patted Linus again. His partner zoomed into the second image and set the footage in motion.
Like I said,
The image is grainy, but we enhanced it the best we could.
Painter leaned closer. The expanded view peered through a back window. The shadowy figure of a man could be seen, and beside him a woman. Though the features were far from clear, she was definitely light-haired, similar profile. But it was more the way she carried herself, the way she moved, that made Painter's breath quicken. Hope surged in him.
It's Lisa.
I wasn't sure, Jason said.
I am.
What about Kat? Painter asked. Other figures were in the car, but they were just indistinct blurs.
I can't say for sure, Jason admitted. And unfortunately, we never did get a clear take on the license plate. If they'd gone through a traffic cam...
It was unfortunate, but it was also a start. And more important, Lisa's alive. He took a deep breath.
I can't say for sure, Jason admitted. And unfortunately, we never did get a clear take on the license plate. If they'd gone through a traffic cam...
It was unfortunate, but it was also a start. And more important, Lisa's alive. He took a deep breath, not letting his relief overwhelm him, knowing matters could change at any moment. Painter only had to look at the neighboring monitor, at the fiery ruins of the clinic, to remind himself again of the Guild's scorched earth policy. The bastards wouldn't leave loose ends. And right now, that was the definition of Lisa and Kat. The same could be said of Gray's team. They were penetrating the latest Guild stronghold, on the trail of the president's daughter. Painter watched the last of the clinic buildings crumble into flame and smoke. It was a fiery warning for Gray, too. Tread lightly.
Chapter 27. July 3rd, 3:13 a.m., Gulf Standard Time, off the coast of Dubai.
They took Amanda into this elevator, Tucker said.
Gray stood with his hands on his hips. He watched Kane sniff along the floor, the shepherd's tail wagging vigorously. He didn't doubt the dog's nose, but he still hesitated. The lobby bay had a dozen elevators banked in a semicircle. He stared up, following the spiraling curve of the translucent staircase. Both the elevators and the stairs ascended the central shaft of the Burj Abadi. Each floor revolved around this stable core.
50 floors, Kowalski said. At least we don't have to climb each one.
But we'll need to stop at each one, Sishan said. Have Kane see if Amanda's trail continues out onto any of those levels.
Gray's three teammates looked to him for their next step. Even Kane stopped his sniffing to glance in his direction.
Gray ignored them for a moment longer.
Something doesn't make sense.
Gray had studied each of the floors on the security cameras. He saw no evidence of life up there, but he had to trust Kane. The dog had gotten them this far. Settled, he reached and hit the call button for the elevator. The doors opened immediately. They all stepped inside the posh lift, appointed in rich exotic woods and crystal lighting.
So, should we start at the top and work our way down? Tucker asked. Or the other way around?
Neither, Gray said, an edge of certainty hardening inside him as he bent down toward the elevator's controls. He pointed to the rows of buttons lined along a flat touchscreen display. Illuminated numbers designated each floor. As he watched, each numeral slowly transformed and rotated through various characters in other languages. Chinese, Japanese, Arabic. Definitely trying to appeal to the global traveler here.
I don't get it, Kowalski said. If we're not going up, then where are we going?
Gray watched the lowest button glow in Arabic. Then it shifted to the English equivalent. LL.
There's a lower level, Seishan said.
Kowalski looked to his toes.
Wait, how could there be a basement on a floating island?
Gray knew this tower had been built in conjunction with the island's construction.
The bedrock upon which the foundation of this tower had been placed was the immense platform holding up Utopia. That concrete and steel stage lay approximately 10 meters under them, leaving plenty of space for a basement here.
"Must be a surface level for the tower," Seishan said.
"And maybe more," Gray added, pressing the button. The letter flashed green, and the cage dropped silently, so smoothly it was hard to tell they were moving at all. "Be ready," Gray warned.
Weapons appeared in hands. Tucker signaled his dog, who lowered his haunches, readying to spring. It felt like the elevator dropped much farther than just one floor, but at last, the doors opened. Gray took a shooter's stance and quickly inspected a small utilitarian lobby, dimly lit and drab. He searched for any guards, but it appeared empty. He stepped out cautiously, leading the way. Hallways branched off with color-designated lines painted on the floor, likely to direct the hotel staff toward kitchens, laundry facilities, maintenance closets, and storage spaces. It looked like a maze down here. Gray waved everyone forward. "Tucker, have Kane hunt for Amanda's trail. She could be anywhere." Tucker set to work with his partner. Gray noted that two other elevators flanked this one. It seemed only 3 of the 12 elevators came down to this level. He had Kowalski hold their door open in case they needed a fast exit. A tall set of windows along one wall drew Gray's attention. He moved closer and stared into a cavernous neighboring space. The room was encased in concrete and climbed 2 stories high. Inside sat a row of massive turbine generators, looking like oversized metal elephants. Control panels covered another wall.
"The building's power plant," Seishan said, joining him.
Gray remembered Jack Kirkland's description of the tidal turbines that powered this building. This must be them. Tucker came back after only a minute.
"Nothing," he said.
Gray turned around, surprised.
"What?"
Tucker shrugged.
"Kane checked all of the hallways leading out from here. Found no sign of Amanda."
"Impossible. She has to be down here."
"Have him check again," he ordered.
"I'll do it, but it's a waste of time. I'll vouch for Kane's nose."
"He's right," Seishan argued. "Coming down here made sense, but that doesn't mean it's the only path. There are 50 other floors. The longer we wait,
the more danger Amanda faces." He sighed heavily, conceding to the logic, but not happy about it. "Back upstairs, then." The others piled inside the elevator. Gray paused at the threshold, staring at the 2 doors that flanked this one.
"Hold on."
He stepped over, pressed the call button, and summoned the other 2 elevators.
"What are you doing?"
Seishan asked from inside the cage, as Kowalski continued to hold the door open. The other 2 elevators arrived. Gray inspected both cages. He returned to the others and studied the touchscreen display in their lift.
"What?"
Seishan pressed. "All 3 of these cages reached the service levels, so why did Amanda's captors use the middle elevator? Human nature says they would have just gone to the one closest to the lobby." Gray pointed to the 1st set of doors. "I checked those other 2. This control panel is 2 inches